David Grush, Robert Jacobs, David Fravor, Robert Salas, Michael Herrera, all UFO whistleblowers who have sworn their testimony before Congress, testified to Arrow, or signed legal affidavits to swear in their statements. Bob Lazar, Mark McCandlish, Bill Uhouse, Boyd Bushman, all UFO whistleblowers with astounding claims persisting throughout the decades, but with no real legal testimony or evidence to back them up. The world has seen myriad whistleblowers since the 1940s, and the nine men I just mentioned are just a drop in the bucket. Though these whistleblowers vary greatly in credibility and believability, all of these men and women deserve to be analyzed with a critical lens regardless of if they are of ironclad reputation and accomplishments, like Grush and Fravor, possess testimony sworn into legal record like Salas and USMC vet Michael Herrera, or claims that are unverifiable yet intriguing but have never been sworn in under legal testimony like Lazar and Bushman. Who knows what whistleblowers with sobering and real testimonies have been overlooked or buried in the annals of UFO lore? Who knows what whistleblowers may give us a peek behind the veil to get a glimpse at the shadowy program that has likely been operating since at least 1947? Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and join me today as I begin part one of an exciting ongoing series studying UFO whistleblowers throughout history. This series will bring light to lesser-known whistleblowers I find worthy of discussing and studying. We will investigate the person making the claims and analyze the context of their claims to see if we can start making heads or tails of the astonishing and perplexing stories of first-hand encounters with UAP. We all know the story of the Roswell crash of 1947. Many, including myself, consider this the inflection point, the nexus of secret UFO study and crash retrieval and reverse engineering efforts.
What can you tell me about the Roswell craft?
Fortunately, those details were not approved for me to talk about right now.
Everyone knows the general story of Roswell, but here's a quick refresher, and I do mean quick, because Roswell is one of the most fascinating stories in human history and deserves at least a 1 to 2 hour video on its investigation. On July 1st through the 3rd, 1947, UFOs were detected on radar from White Sands Missile Range, which had been testing nuclear weapons since 1946. On July 4th, a UFO disappears off radar scope. This is likely the crash date. The following day, July 5th, the area of North Roswell is quarantined. Guards were stationed north of town on Highway 285 blocking roads. This same day, debris and bodies were shipped out of Roswell Hangar 84 to either Wright Pat or Fort Worth, Texas. The following day, rancher Mac Brazel takes a box of debris into his local sheriff's office. Brazel had discovered a wreckage field on Foster Ranch 75 miles north of Roswell. Intelligence officer Jesse Marcel Sr. was dispatched to observe and recover the wreckage. And it is crucial to note here the existence of two separate locations from Roswell. This is always a misconception I see. The debris field discovered by Brazel and investigated by Marcel was not the location where the craft and bodies were allegedly recovered. The debris field was 3.4 miles long and 300 feet wide and consisted solely of craft ejecta. Strange metallic material was discovered that was almost massless, yet retained shape and showed resistance to blunt and shear trauma. I highly recommend my Battelle video, as this wreckage was likely studied by Battelle Memorial Institute. The second location, just north of Roswell, was kept far more under wraps, and there's far more secrecy around this location. Anyways, Marcel loaded wreckage onto a military jeep and on the way home to the Roswell Army Airfield, showed his family pieces of the wreckage, including his son, Jesse Marcel Jr. On July 8th, in a press conference mandated by Colonel William Blanchard and confirmed by the 509th Bomb Group Public Relations Officer, Lieutenant Walter Hott, the RAAF revealed a flying disc crashed and was in Air Force possession. The same day, headlines were made stating RAAF captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. That same day, the Roswell story is killed. General Roger Ramey ordered a retraction to the saucer news, shifting the story to a recovered weather balloon. Marcel was photographed in Ramey's office with aluminum foil not recovered material for press purposes. Marcel himself later admitted to this in a 1978 interview with the legendary Stanton Freeman, where he revealed he was ordered to participate in a cover-up. Marcel ordered his family not to talk about the wreckage. Blanchard goes on leave, Brazel disappears, and Marcel moves to Fort Worth. Nobody could be contacted about the events, and the story is killed for decades. So where does Lieutenant Walter Hott of the 509th Bomb Group fit into this as a whistleblower? Well, first let's start with his credentials. During World War II, Hott was a bombardier who flew 35 missions in Japan. He participated in A-bomb testing in Bikini Atoll and served in the 509th Atomic Bomb Group at Roswell Army Airfield at the time of the alleged crash in 1947. An interesting fact, his group, the 509th, was the Air Force wing that dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. For years after the event and Jesse Marcel's admitted cover-up in 1978, Hott stayed silent. It wasn't until the early 90s he began speaking up. On May 14, 1993, Hott wrote and signed an official affidavit discussing his experience at Roswell.
He wanted put into a press release when the colonel tells the first lieutenant almost verbatim what he wants in a press release. Guess what he gets? You don't argue with him and say, oh, I think it'd sound better if we said it this way or the next way. The answer to all was yes, sir.
So what exactly did the press release say?
In essence, it was very simple, to the effect that we had in our possession a flying saucer. It was found on a ranch up north of Roswell. It was being flown to General Ramey's office.
Here, Hott discusses how Colonel Blanchford, the base commander, called Walter at RAAF to say he had in his possession a flying saucer or parts from a disc. He stated these pieces came from a ranch northwest of Roswell, and intelligence officer Jesse Marcel would fly the materials to Fort Worth.
Information that I got was given to me almost verbatim by Colonel Blanchard, and he read off of a scratch pad that he had in front of him what he was saying to me, and I was writing it down, and after we got all through with it, I kind of awed, and he said, I want you to give it to the local newspapers and radio stations and do it post haste. And all he got in reply was a yes sir, and away I went. I meant that they put all the hunks and pieces in a, I think it was at that time, C-54 aircraft that they loaded up primarily with the material, and that airplane was flown. The material was not flown.
So Hott says that material were loaded into aircraft. The aircraft took off, but the material did not. Also, Blanchford ordered Hott to write a news release about the operation to be delivered to two radio stations in Roswell and both of the newspapers, the Daily Record and the Dispatch newspapers. Hott was stunned by the following retraction and changing of the story to a weather balloon by General Roger Ramey, and believed there was no chance neither Blanchford nor Marcel mistook the wreckage for a weather balloon. Marcel even admitted his involvement, like I stated earlier, and he also did privately to Walter in 1980. Interestingly enough, we can look at the signed affidavit made by Arthur McQuitty, the managing editor of the Roswell Morning Dispatch at the time of the incident. McQuitty here confirms the delivery of the press release by Hott and the subsequent call made from the RAAF, saying the release was incorrect and the wreckage was that of a recovered balloon. McQuitty was also good friends with Colonel Blanchford, and months after the event, the colonel told the editor, quote, I will tell you this and nothing more. The stuff I saw, I've never seen any place else in my life. Oh, and by the way, we do have even more legal affidavits here, such as from Fort Worth Army Airfield Colonel Thomas J. DuBose, who confirmed the material shown with Jesse Marcel in Ramey's office were indeed a weather balloon used as a cover story. In addition to this, he states he was in charge of arranging the requested materials be sent from RAAF to Fort Worth, which were then sent on to General Chidlaw at Wright Field. Shockingly, this is not the only affidavit signed and written by Haught, meaning maybe he didn't tell all of his story here in the early 90s. In 2002, Haught completed another legal document to be released 2 years after his death. After his passing in 2005, 2007 saw the release of Haught's final statements. Here, Haught expands on his first-hand encounters with the Roswell incident. On the morning of July 8th, Walter attended the staff meeting with Colonel Blanchford, General Ramey, and Chief of Staff Colonel Dubose, among others. The topic of this discussion was the freshly discovered debris field found 75 miles northwest of Roswell, and the primary site 40 miles north of town. Samples of wreckage were passed around the meeting, and here Haught once again confirms the lightweight, metallic alloy with shape retention abilities, this time featuring some strange markings. These markings were actually discussed by Marcel Sr. and his son, who saw the wreckage his father brought home, Jesse Marcel Jr. The team did not know whether or not to go public with the findings. General Ramey proposed a plan to divert attention away from the more important site just north of town, the craft site, by drawing much more attention to the debris field. At 9:30 a.m., Blanchford dictated the press release about a flying disc to Haught. Before leaving the base, Blanchfield took the 509th Lieutenant to Building 84, a B-29 hangar that was under heavy guard control on both the interior and exterior. Once inside, Haught was allowed to view what had been recovered just north of town. He observed an egg-shaped craft, 12 to 15 feet in length and 6 feet in diameter, with a metallic surface. The craft had no windows, portholes, wings, landing gear, or tail section, and this description reminds me very closely of the craft as described by Arrow whistleblower Eric Tabor that was stored in Area 51. Additionally, the lieutenant saw a couple bodies under a canvas tarp. Only the heads were visible, and Walter could make out no features due to the poor lining. But the bodies were the size of a 10-year-old child, roughly 4 feet high, with larger than normal heads. A temporary morgue here was set up, and in another video, I will cover the sworn statements of this Roswell mortician. And finally, Haught reiterates what was told to him by Marcel, that the officer took pieces of the wreckage to General Ramey's office, and upon returning from a map room, discovering balsa wood and foil from a weather balloon and radar kite. Why Walter never revealed this story earlier? Well, he said he swore to Blanchard he would never reveal what he saw in his lifetime. And now we get onto another former USG military personnel, Brigadier General Stephen Lovkin, who appeared on Stephen Greer's 2001 Disclosure Project. Now, don't be swooning over the title Brigadier General just yet, folks. Lovkin was a quote-unquote Brigadier General in the North Carolina State Guard, a volunteer militia with no official military standing. So Greer embellished Lovkin's credentials, or didn't vet this through enough. However, Lovkin did enter the Army in 1958, and joined the Pentagon's Radio Frequency Engineering Office. Stephen then went on to the White House Army Signaling Agency in 1959 as a technical specialist. Lovkin served in both the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations with an above top secret clearance. Also, from multiple independent sources, including the esteemed ufologist Joe Mergia, Lovkin was also an attendee to the 1998 briefing with Dr. Greer, Dr. Mitchell, Rear Admiral Thomas Wilson, Commander Will Miller, and others. This meeting featured in the Wilson-Davis memo was confirmed by Wilson himself to be true. If you don't know about the WD memo, this was the first video I ever made and what I consider to be one of the most important documents of all time. Link to this video will be in the description. So let's start to look at and analyze some of Lovkin's claims.
I learned a lot about Project Blue Book. Blue Book was discussed quite openly in the office. Sections of Blue Book were opened for discussion. And then there were other matters as well that were brought to our attention one afternoon when...
Lovkin's work at the White House Army Signaling Agency dealt with code breaking, In the process, he learned much about the ongoing Blue Book. He states, quote, "The findings that were put in there were highly scientific. They were highly gone over by the people that knew what they wanted to put in there. This information was information that would never get out to anyone else. But it was designed for the use of particular military personnel. What was there was extremely exact and scientific."
You saw an awful lot. You saw a lot of little pictures. Most of the pictures we have seen duplicates of today. Some were, the pictures that I saw were, I think, maybe a little bit better. They were taken by Air Force pilots, as well
of
the UFOs. Yes.
So they actually had pictures of UFOs in these
pictures. Oh, indeed they did. Yes, not only the Air Force, but some were taken by civilian pilots. Some were taken by Marine Air Corps pilots. And some were foreign.
Quote, "I would say there were probably between 200 and 300 cases of lock-on, and that's why those cases were in there, because they were authentic," end quote. Interesting to me is how all of this particular language for particular personnel never seemed to make it into the official declassified Project Blue Book reports. Equally as interesting are the alleged photos that, along with numerous cases, were omitted from Blue Book. The lock-on statement is additionally accurate. If you remember from my video on the history of the UFO stigma, Major Hector Quintanilla lied to Congress that Blue Book uncovered zero radar lock-on cases. Fortunately, this statement was later on corrected by the infamous J. Allen Hynek, who supplied multiple such radar identification cases. And what gives Lovkin some more credibility to me is his mention of the Air Force when discussing Blue Book. He states, quote, "The Air Force at that time was very, very much concerned with Blue Book, and there were strict regulations involving anything that had to do with reporting of UFOs or talking about a UFO. If you wanted to ruin your career, it was explained to us, the thing that would do this fastest was to talk about UFOs," end quote. As someone who talks every video now about USAF Reg 200-2, I find it admirable and interesting Lovkin makes this connection. I know what you're thinking, guys. Gerb, we all know Blue Book was a front. You talk about it in every single video you make. Everyone knows that scientific evidence was compartmented outside of Blue Book. Is this all Lovkin has to offer? Well, there's a reason I put Lovkin here in the same video with Walter Haught. During a meeting discussing Blue Book materials, Lovkin claimed one Colonel Hollabard, which may be a Greer misspelling of Hollow Guard or Hollow Berg, brought out a metallic piece similar to a yardstick. The metal had encryption on it, described by Hollabard as symbols of instruction so important they can keep the military working on them at a consistent basis.
They went on to further explain that this was the material that had come from the New Mexico crash in 1947. Well, he said it had been taken from one of the craft that had crashed in New Mexico, and that it had been taken from a box of materials that the military was working on. They didn't use the word reverse engineering at that time, but it was something similar to the reverse engineering.
Anybody who knows the Roswell story, and now the whistleblower Walter Haught, knows the infamous encrypted, quote, I-beam. The piece Jesse Marcel Sr. showed his son. This famous material from the alleged crash has actually been claimed to have been viewed by many people, and I encourage you to take a dive. In the video description will be a link to all witness accounts. But that's not all Lovkin had to say about Roswell. He even comments on one of the most fascinating yet contentious aspects of the case, bodies.
And the next day it was discussed again. They did discuss the fact that there were bodies.
Extraterrestrial
bodies, yes. There were either three or five, and they didn't even know at that point, because some of the information that they had gotten apparently was incomplete. But three or five stands out in my mind as the number that were taken. One was alive, partially alive at the time that this happened.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea.
In 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower gave the forever famous speech warning about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. I, and I'm sure many other UFO researchers, have wondered if he was partly referring to the legacy UFO programs here. The program Grush speaks of, that Admiral Wilson almost uncovered, the program that has been attempting to reverse engineer and recover UFO since at least Roswell in 1947. Eisenhower's connections to UFO lore are legendary. After all, the alleged MJ-12 documents state the shadowy group reported to Truman and Eisenhower, and we cannot forget the astonishing story of Eisenhower meeting with a group of extraterrestrials after their landing at Holloman Air Force Base in 1954. The story goes, Eisenhower made an agreement with these beings. I've yet to dive too much into this alleged encounter between a president and extraterrestrials, but was this what Grush was referring to when he said deals had been made with NHI?
And it's quite clear that you're talking about agreements between America and non-human intelligences. Have we made agreements with non-human intelligences?
That's the kind of information I really hope national leadership is able to get to the bottom of.
I need to pin you down on this. Are there agreements between non-human intelligences and the American government?
I think that's a question that I would like to know all the details of as well.
There are more sobering stories of Eisenhower being read into the current estimates of the UFO phenomenon during his presidency, but losing control. This is the estimated time where the program broke free of government and congressional oversight, and this seems to be the stance that Lovkin takes, and he can offer some valuable context here, so I'm going to let this short clip play in its entirety.
The whole process of dealing with the UFO phenomenon could not be handled anymore by one agency, and so in order to keep it alive, and I guess as cheaply as possible, it was given to various and sundry parts of the government to work on, and I guess they thought that they could also keep the intelligence factor as secret as possible by giving little agencies a little bit here and a little bit there, and that oftentimes is done with matters like this. But what happened was Eisenhower got sold out. Without him knowing it, he lost control of what was going on with the entire, I think, with the entire UFO situation. But I think he was telling us the military-industrial complex will stick you in the back if you are not totally vigilant. And I think he felt like he had not been vigilant. I think he felt like he trusted too many people. And Eisenhower was a trusting man. He was a good man, and I think that he realized that all of a sudden this matter is going into the control of corporations that could very well be used in detriment to this country. I think the frustration, from what I can remember, went on for months. He realized that he was losing control. He realized that the phenomenon of whatever it was that we were faced with was not going to be in the best hands, and that those were the, as far as I can remember, that was the expression that was used. It's not going to be in the best hands.
In a separate interview with author Grant Cameron, Lovkin stated he attended Camp David with Eisenhower and other staff on multiple occasions. Although just a sergeant at the time, Stephan noted the good nature of Eisenhower, who made sure to know the name of each and every person. One night, Lovkin overheard the president on a telephone call begin to discuss the 1952 UFOs over Washington, D.C. incident. Apparently, this wasn't a rare occasion, as UFOs were, quote, a very, very important concern of his, end quote. Eisenhower was additionally concerned about losing control over the military-industrial complex. Lovkin states the president began being kept out of information regarding UAP later in his term. In his Disclosure Project interview, Lovkin also comments on UFOs being a career killer to speak about openly. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. An older officer involved with the CIA and DIA told him uncovering revelations about the phenomenon could lead to somebody being erased.
He said those threats have been made and carried out. He said those threats started way back in 1947. The Army was given, or the Air Force, excuse me, was given the absolute control over how to handle this. This being the biggest security situation that this country has ever dealt with. I guess fear has done it. I don't care what kind of a person you are. I don't care how strong or courageous you are. It would be a very fearful situation because from what Matt said, he said they'll go after not only you. He said they'll go after your family. Now, those were his words.
Have people been killed to protect this secret?
Based on the people I talked to, that was an ongoing concern. Yeah, unfortunately, I've heard some really un-American things I don't want to repeat right now.
So you have a strong suspicion that people have been murdered to protect the secret?
Over the years, yeah.
Hey guys, thank you so much for joining me today as I start this new series diving into UFO whistleblowers and their claims. Let me get something out of the way. I'm sorry for the disheveled appearance. Yesterday, May 4th, I tested for my purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and along the way, I took some injuries, including a pretty nasty eye poke, so I'm just thankful I can see out of this eye. But I was really inspired to cover these two men, Walter Haught and Stephen Lovkin. Stephen, Stefan, I know I probably got it wrong, so I'm sorry. Let me have it in the comments. I know I mispronounce things every single video, but I wanted to cover these two men due to the relevancy of their claims. I stay away from stating my personal opinion most of the time until the end of the videos, such as here, but I personally do believe that 1947 Roswell, New Mexico, some sort of non-human intelligence craft crashed. I think this is the nexus of reverse engineering programs, possibly Magenta Italy earlier, but maybe the program wasn't so condensed and compartmentalized and efficient then, but I think Roswell is one of the largest incidents in UFO history. And I think Haught is one of the best whistleblowers and people to discuss his experience with this, with Blanchard, with General Ramey, because as everybody knows, General Ramey, the man who needed to kill the Roswell story, is also the same general who gave the press release with General Samford in 1952 following the UFOs over Washington, D.C. So just a relevant whistleblower, relevant case to talk about. So you can tell by the shirt, very passionate about Roswell. And Stephen Lovkin, not only does he talk more about Roswell, but I think he has a lot of keen insights to offer about kind of where this program started to spiral out, this legacy program Grush talks about, and some of the crimes they've committed, including murder, and not just attacking people, but attacking their family as well. I think it's pretty probable that around the 1960s, with Dwight D. Eisenhower, private corporations and parts of the legacy program being in the private sector and funded through private corporations and IRAD really started to break away in the 60s. I believe this is when congressional and presidential oversight were lost with the program. So I personally find Lovkin quite credible. The biggest stain here, of course, is the Brigadier General thing for a volunteer militia. I really wish Stephen Greer wouldn't have included that in the video, because even the slightest bit of research, you can kind of tell that that's a little bit of an embellishment, so that's definitely a little bit of a credibility stain on his case. But I thought these two whistleblowers were the perfect two people to kind of get our feet wet and get started. In the future, we will have whistleblowers, crash retrieval whistleblowers, reverse engineering whistleblowers, just sighting whistleblowers, radar whistleblowers, all types of whistleblowers you can imagine. I bet I could make a 20-part series on this with 2 to 3 people per. So again, guys, thank you so much for joining. Please remember to like and subscribe for all my crew that watches the UFC. Last night, UFC 301 went down. Urseg got robbed. He won rounds 2, 3, and 4. Round 5 was the swing round Pantoja took. Overall, great card. Happy to see Anthony Smith back. Always like watching him win because he is the best fighter on paper. But thank you so much, guys, and I will catch everybody on the next show.